Today on the Mark Steiner Show, we are bringing you a special broadcast of an important community town hall event that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network that I moderated. We wrestled with a question we've discussed here on the Mark Steiner Show a lot. Should the community control the police department? Could a police civilian review board with real power be the answer? Over the course of the next 2 hours, we'll hear from Baltimore police officers, public officials, activists, and community members. Including in the mix are the voices of the ACLU's Sonia Kumar, community activist Kim Truhart, Adam Jackson, the leaders of the Beautiful Struggle, Chief of the Baltimore Police Department's Community Partnership Division, Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell, criminal attorney Dwight Pettit, former Black Panther leader Eddie Conway, Alok Mukherjee of the Toronto Police Services Board, and Dr. Ray Winbush of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. Since this is pre-taped, we obviously can't take your calls. However, if you hear something during the course of this discussion that inspires you, please tweet me at Mark Steiner or email me at talk@steinershow.org so we can continue this discussion on the air in the coming weeks. And without further ado, here's our broadcast of the Real News Network's Town Hall, Should the Community Control the Police?, which took place earlier this week in Baltimore.
People will say, I don't see color. Well, look in a prison if you are feeling colorblind. That out of the millions of people in prison, more than half are people of color, because as a nation led by Ronald Reagan, we chose incarceration instead of rehabilitation. Health issues are never addressed in the institution because the institution itself is a health issue. A retired police chief told the New York Times he was offered tanks, bazookas, and anything else he wanted. The Pentagon developed monetary incentives to ensure military practices on common people so that your mother, your brother, your sister, your aunt, your uncle are all public enemy number one. But when was the last time a SWAT team was in the suburb? Threw a grenade in a mansion without probable cause, the only difference is race. Because statistically, blacks and whites use and sell drugs at similar rates, but blacks just lack the private space. So the outdoor market is more accessible to arrest. Police target us because it is easy. Because we are already on the corner and criminalizing what we call the hood is the aftermath of a battlefield, but I dare you to put a blue light in a white man's house. Bloomberg, his neighborhood. Stop and frisk his sons and daughters. Make them spread eagle until you want to get your eagle every year. Billions of dollars sustains the prison industrial complex. They will spend more money imprisoning us than feeding us. It is not about the prison time. It's about the prison label. Because felon is an alternative word for slave. And what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society and more to do with the language we use to justify it. So I refuse consent. You can bring your dog and even your firing squad. I am tired of an American dream being shattered with shackles I will not identify. How many of our leaders must die before we decide that not next year, 5 years, 10 years, or a century from now, but now, 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 is the only time structure we will ever believe in. So we are all just prisoners, incarcerated in the belief that we have time to make change happen, but I will never sit and hope for change. I spend every day fighting for it because as long as the system of white supremacy thrives, slavery will never die.
So let's begin by kind of looking at what might be at the root of this abuse and where it comes from on a bunch of different levels, and whether it's inherent in just policing something deeper, what's in our society. But I want to turn to Neil Franklin first. Neil Franklin is sitting here in the front row. We introduce him for a moment. Neil Franklin has been was a police officer for over 30 years in the Maryland State Police, where he was an officer, then came to Baltimore, where he ran the training center in Baltimore City for the police for 4 years, and now is the executive director of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And Neil has seen it from many ends and led one of the most famous drug raids ever to take place on the block in the history of Baltimore when he was a commander in the Maryland State Police. So with that introduction, just to get a sense of who you are and why you're saying what you're saying, let's talk about the roots of that. When you talk about training, when you talk about what's inside the police department, what you've seen, how do you perceive whether this abuse comes from inside the police and why?
I would really like to talk about the history of policing in general.
Start
in this country, I don't know if you have that much time. You know, because the police in this country have been used to deal with certain populations of people, period. Go all the way back to slavery. The police have been an instrument to suppress the black community, to oppress the black community. And I don't think policing has ever escaped from that. You know, and I know hopefully there'll be some others here to talk about some more about that history. But as we come forward, system after system after system is put in place. And the most recent system that has been put in place is the drug war, is the prohibition of drugs. You know, it's a health issue. It's an educational issue that we are trying to solve through criminal justice. You know, it's not about health. You know, when Richard Nixon started the war on drugs, it wasn't really about health. It was about the black community and having a system, a process, something in place to deal with the blacks while not appearing to be really what it is. The police have been hoodwinked too. Don't get me wrong, there are police officers that should not wear the badge, absolutely. But we have been handcuffed because we have to enforce these policies. We don't dare enforce these policies in Roland Park, okay, because of the political capital, because of the finance resources that they have, because of the attorneys and so on and so forth. The black community, you can do anything you want. And unfortunately, policing today is about numbers.
That's for sure.
It's about numbers. Yeah. And where can you get those numbers with the least resistance, the least amount of pushback within the black community? One of the things I want to make sure that we do here tonight is not talk about just individual pieces that we want to attack, but this has to be resolved holistically. So the systems that are put in place, as I just mentioned, yes, the police officers that should not be wearing the badge, yes, civilian review boards that have power and subpoena power, and we should be, the community should be policing the police for
that. Let me jump in for a moment. Kenneth Butler, I'm glad you were here as well, president of Vanguard Justice Society, right?
Yes.
And active in the FOP as well.
Yes.
I guess one of the questions that people have is that people in Baltimore City and many cities around the country feel abused. They feel disrespected when pulled over by the police and stopped. I'm going to call on somebody to give a story here in a moment that just happened to him a few weeks ago that I know about when he was driving his car. Why is that? Where does that come from? Is it the training? Is it a question of the power that police have in our community and how they have to use it? The distrust of anybody, even if you are black, who is black, that's being stopped?
I think it's a lack of training. And when I was a kid, policing was about, it wasn't about numbers. It was about you knew officer friendly, and it was about the cops could knock on your door because...
And be invited.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And today, with it being a numbers game, you have a lot of officers, they just have to get numbers.
What do you mean they have to get numbers? What does that mean?
They have to get a certain amount of arrests. They have to get a certain amount of car stops. They have to get a certain amount of tickets. But when I was a kid, it was not like that.
Let me just jump over here because I'm going to Kim Truehart and I'm going to go to Eddie Conway. Hey, Kim, I'm going to you now because before I go to Eddie, both of you are lifelong Baltimore residents. You grew up in this town, both of you. And I hear what you're saying, and I think there is that sense that that time existed. But when you were young, and I was young, there was a story of the Vini brothers in Baltimore City in 1964. And in 1942, there was the Brotus case, and many cases in between. There wasn't a drug war taking place. This was in the black community. When the Vini brothers committed the crime they committed, police went in every door in the black community in Baltimore on the west side, kicked down doors, threw people down, beat people up, arrested people, became the hallmark of that moment. So why I'm saying that is from what the two of you just said. That's why I'm trying to probe here. Is it something deeper than a drug war? Is it something deeper than something that's just happening in this era?
Police are authorized by the political system to oppress us. Then we do feel like we're victimized. And our children get victimized. Our young people get victimized. Just trying to engage in everyday life around this city. And unfortunately, it's a numbers game. It's about money. That's absolutely what it's about, money.
Very good. In 10 words or less, what do you mean money?
Well, the rich need to get richer, you know. But we went to, you know, a hearing Monday where BG&E is asking for another rate increase, yeah. And how do you do that,
Eddie?
Yeah, well, see, it's been my experience when I was growing up in the East Baltimore, in the black community. Almost every weekend, Friday nights, Saturday nights, Sunday nights, there would be incidents between the residents and the police. So I think it's more than just the lack of training. It's a them against us kind of situation that once you have an incident in the community, then it has to be suppressed. And they come in and they suppress it with force. And I'm talking 45 years ago, by not having a real representation in the city council and in other places, there was no flack, there was nobody to answer to. Unlike Roland Park or Pimlico or other areas in which there would be an outcry and a response. Outcries were never met with any satisfaction in terms of relief. So it's more than training. It's a mental attitude. It's like war. It's a mental attitude that causes a reaction against any incident in the community.
The question about whether police feel like they're in a war constantly, is that the footing police are on? Is that what's in police mindset? Is that how the community sees the police? Is that part of what happens when you were a young patrolman getting out of your car?
No, I don't think that's what's happening. I agree with the chief. I agree with Kenny. It is a training issue. I think it's a supervision issue also. Mm-hmm. But most importantly, I think it's a cultural understanding issue.
Yes.
Or lack thereof.
Or lack thereof. Mm-hmm. Baltimorean. Like my brothers and everyone that spoke before me, Baltimoreans grew up in Baltimore. When I became a police officer, no one had to teach me to be abusive or not to be abusive. I knew not to be abusive. I understood my people. I understood the culture. And so you could go back and I know a lot of great cops. There are some bad cops, but I know a lot of great cops. Mm-hmm. And you can go back into their files and the archives of their workforce, and you will find that no one had to teach them how to be community police officers. When we came up, just like Kenny was saying, we spoke to everybody. We knew everybody. We didn't abuse anybody. Yeah, there was times you had a scuffle and you had to get into it, right? But when it was over, it was over. Cuffs went on. Fighting stopped.
But let me just push a bit on this. And I hear what you're saying. And I just be clear. My nephew is a cop. I have police who were my students. I'm still very close to who have grown up. So the question is, mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. But I want to get to what's under this. Why is it that when police stop people in the city, there are too many cases of people being pulled out of their cars, disrespected?
I thought I addressed them, Mark.
It's a combination of everything. It's the cultural underflow that has never been dealt with because we keep dumping system on top of system. But it's a training issue. Okay, it's a supervision issue. It's all of those things that we've never been able to properly deal with because of what's being asked of these police officers and what these systems, you know, do to our young people in the street.
And you're about to say something, Wendell.
Yeah, another big part of the puzzle is the lack of accountability, not only from those in the department. There's also a lack of accountability in the actual judicial system. I've had cases... I remember Dwight Pettit had represented a gentleman where a judge actually apologized for having to sentence this man. It was a white gentleman. Cool. And it was that dealing with the voter suppression, black voter suppression. I can't remember the gentleman's name who you represented, but I was there for sentencing because I was interested.
Sherrick.
I was interested to see what type of sentence he was going to get. The judge said, I'm sorry I have to do this to you. Wow. And so you have situations like that. You have police officers who will tell a lie on the stand, and the judge knows, finds your client not guilty for it. And I had that case happen to one of my clients. The judge said, I'm sorry, officer, but based upon the evidence, I'm going to have to find this client not guilty. So you have situations like this that's not only pervasive in the police department, but you also have these attitudes that pervade the judicial system. And just doing it with the police department is not enough. That there needs to be reform in the entire criminal justice system.
I think that's true. I'm only calling D. Watkins. D. Watkins is a young man who grew up in the East Side, is now becoming one of our region's and nation's leading young authors and has written some incredible work. But when we were together the other night, D., you told me a story about you getting stopped.
It's not a training issue, and it's not a supervision issue. It's a humanity issue. It's when I'm When I'm in East Baltimore, when I'm down the hill, when I'm over Latrobe Housing Projects, anywhere in East Baltimore in general, there's no love. I've never heard a police officer say the word love. So many cops who I encountered, they don't police the neighborhoods with love. They don't believe in the citizens. They have no connection to the citizens, and they don't care about them. So it's easy for this guy to pound on this guy's face. It's easy for, you know, all the stuff that goes down with cops like Mike Fry and Daniel Hershey and all the ones who live in the Baltimore Sun. It's easy for them to operate because they don't love the people they police. They don't care at all. So, you know, that's the first thing. But or even just to continue with that, I was telling Mark about one incident when I was pulled over. But that's just one incident. I've been pulled over so many times for so many stupid reasons. And I'm not a reckless driver at all. Like, I never go over the speed limit. I always wear a seatbelt. I'm scared to speed because I'm just not that guy. I'm not a guy who drives fast. I'm a guy who drives slow. So, you know, it's easy for you to stop a person if you don't care about them. It's easy for you to throw that day off. You know, I've told cops plenty of times, look, I'm a college professor. I'm a teacher. I'm not a person that's making all types of wild, crazy money. With the small amount of money I make, I pay your salary. This is a service. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of hard for me to talk to some of the cops who I talk to about.
I'm just want to get some other folks in here, but go ahead, finish your thought.
Okay. It's hard for me to talk to a police officer who's telling me that they honor their badge and they love that badge, and they're proud wearing that badge when they know of all the things that go on and they don't do anything about it.
Jill Carter.
I agree with just about everything that's been said. I, too, was born in Baltimore and grew up in Baltimore, and I've seen a cultural change in policing from the time I was young until now. And it is that I believe that we've allowed, it is a humanity issue, but we've allowed the public perception to be changed, that the perception of society to be changed, such that black people, poor people, are not deemed human, have no human value in the eyes of the law. And that is the problem. That's the fundamental problem. It's education and training, but and a little bit's been said. I could talk all day about this, but in terms of policy, that's where leadership comes, and that's where it's incumbent upon those in political office, the leader of the city, the leader of the state, to make it clear that the policy is there will be no brutality. The policy is, from the commissioner down to the lowest level officer up, that in every individual district, sergeant, if there's brutality, you're responsible for that. Major, you're responsible for that. So that we don't have incidents where there's not only officers that execute brutality, but those that remain in silence and do nothing about it. It should be clear that there are repercussions for all of that, and that's the way we change it. And then finally,
I have to jump in because I agree wholeheartedly, but it's got to be instant accountability. It's got to be right there, immediate, on the spot. We've seen several incidents within the last 6, 7, 8 months where police have committed heinous acts and nothing happens to them until we all see the elevator video. And the police, as well as the citizens, need to know. When I was little and I got in trouble, I was punished instantly. My mother and father didn't wait for the video. Oh, well, let's wait see what the video said. They took immediate action. Well, you know, the police department, I mean to cut you off, but the police department, they I don't know what these officers think, but I feel that they think that they can do what they want to do. So, and the citizens have lost confidence.
I want to get back to the officers.
Let me just speak to that. The reason it's not instance, and for anybody who's been watching the news the last couple of weeks, couple of months, you know that we have a police commissioner that's frustrated with that component where he can't have immediate action. And the thing that's in place that, listen, none of us are at fault here for putting this in place. I think it goes back, and you attorneys are here, you know way better than I do. 1971 or something, the law enforcement officers, Bill of Rights. That handcuffed, so you can't have that instant.
I would
it's
disagree.
Not that you don't want it.
I would disagree.
Let me just say this. When we talk about accountability, it is the laws. It's the law enforcement officer Bill of Rights. But it's also, when you talk about immediate action, it's knowing that whoever's on patrol there, whoever's in supervision, as someone said, that person will take immediate action, that it won't be tolerated. So it's both. It's the laws, but it's also what happens and there's the policies in the department and the supervision. And so I think you have to have both, and that's where we come in.
There's nothing in the law that I see that says that the state's attorney can't take immediate action if he or she sees it taking place.
Exactly.
He doesn't have to wait for a grand jury. He doesn't have to wait for a grand jury. They don't have to wait for all the... They can do the same thing they do to any other citizen who breaks the law. And the police commissioner can do things internally by suspending somebody with pay, taking their gun away, putting them on leave until something happens. And that doesn't seem to happen ever in our world.
Well, I would disagree because me being a lieutenant, and I'll say the situation where you just showed with the
officer was punching the man.
Yes, right. Yes. Now, if I'm the lieutenant on that scene and I see this, first of all, we're not trained like that. Okay. Now, with that, me being a lieutenant, I have the authority to suspend that officer right there. Some of that authority has been taken away from us. For what reason, we do not know.
Taken away from the lieutenant level, you're saying?
Taken away from the sergeants and the lieutenants. And I have argued this with the commissioner. You know, he has his reasons. And I said, well, sir, I think you're handcuffing the supervisors to a certain extent. Because there were some supervisors who went overboard with suspensions. So the commissioner had to say, hey, look, some of the suspensions need to slow down. But a situation like that, and I'm just speaking for me, then I would have suspended that officer on the spot because we're not trained like that.
You're both been waiting.
And I'm speaking to accountability. It's not a race issue. It's not a problem of poor. It's an accountability issue.
Absolutely.
And transparency issue all around the board. I'm not a Baltimorean. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. But I lived in Baltimore for the last 20 years, and I was assaulted in Baltimore by Baltimore City Police. And I say that because I've been stopped in first since I've been 10 years old, going through the same type of situations and beating the same type of situations. But what I'm speaking to at this point is the accountability piece. If we are not holding ourselves accountable, the civilians too, because this happens to the youth that I work with all the time. They can't afford an attorney. They can't afford a Dwight Pettit or a Jay Wendell Gordon to represent them.
Go ahead, and then go to Seema.
My name is Brother Bay, and I'm the founder of the Fraternal Order of Ex-Offenders. There must be reflection, then action.
That's right.
Let me deal with it. It is a racist issue. Police departments, I'm a residential criminologist, when they come into the black community, their behavior is gang for the organization, which is paramilitary, and the officer. When they do the same thing in white folks' community, it causes the police department and the officer strain. There's no parity in disparities. All you got to do is look at the faces of that 111 people who was compensated, and it's not beyond police brutality. It's police corruption. It's police crime.
The issue of poverty. We've heard a couple people say it's not poverty. But there's the issue in this country of class and race and where poverty fits into it. If police respond to a call of a disturbance on Roland Avenue, or they have to go down to Guilford Avenue further south by Greenmount, we're going to respond differently. It has to do with class and poverty and race as well. Eddie?
Yes, because, I mean, basically, when you look at a police department, their primary mission is to protect wealth and property and to protect those people that are wealthy and that own that property. And the reaction in the community is to keep the community completely under control, those people that doesn't have any wealth and doesn't have any power, they have to maintain a certain level of control. And now what we're seeing is there's no jobs in the community for a large segment of people, so that means that there's going to be always some sort of sub-economy going on. There's going to be an illegal activity. And that activity has to be controlled, suppressed, and whatnot, so that it doesn't go to the inner harbor or it doesn't go to people of power. And so pretty much the mandate is to control. And it goes back to what he was saying in terms of slavery. It used to be they were controlling the slave population. And then they became police forces. And in other areas in the North, New England state, it was to control the property for the wealth and keep those unemployed or keep anybody else that's trying to get some of that, you know. So it's really an issue of protecting the wealth.
Let me tell Ray Winbush.
There's always people who don't have color hurting people who do have color. That's a consistent pattern throughout the nation. With regard to training, I mean, I hear what you're saying, brother, but that's not it. The officers that choked Eric Garner to death in Long Island this past summer had over 30 years of training. It's not training. It's racial. And it's something that the denial of racism is one of the biggest problems in policing in this country. And see, white people don't make good minorities. And the reason why, and because they don't make good minorities, they feel that they have to do something, as Eddie said, and as so many other people said, about how do you control the bodies of African people. That is something since enslavement, and it still persists in our society today.
That's an excerpt from a town meeting that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network in Baltimore around the question, should the community control the police? There's much more of this discussion to come after this break. And we're listening to Tony Bennett's Rags to Riches, which hit number one on this day in 1953. And can you believe he is still singing?
And though my pocket may be empty, I'd be a millionaire. My clothes may...
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Ray Charles. Hard-hearted Hannah. Ray Charles had four singles on the Billboard Hot 100 chart on this day in 1964. Today on the program, we are bringing you a special broadcast of an important community town hall event that took place earlier in the week at the Real News Network. We wrestled with a question that we've discussed a great deal here on the Mark Steiner Show. Should the community control the police department? Could a police civilian review board with real power be the answer? Here's more of that conversation, which included Baltimore law enforcement officials, public officials, activists, and community members.
One of the most important tools for the public to be able to combat the use of excessive force and harassment should be Baltimore's Civilian Review Board. The nine current members of the board are appointed by the mayor and meet once a month. Their job is to review allegations of abuse, but if their account differs from the police department's report, there's little room for them to move forward.
We have what the state legislation gave us, and that's after we review the cases. If it is different from what the Baltimore City Police Department have, all we really can do is send a recommendation.
And how often does the police commissioner agree with your findings and take action?
We haven't got any back where they reverse their finding.
Any in 14 years?
Nope.
When the review board was created in 2000, lawmakers omitted how the board would actually be funded. The director of the board's umbrella agency at the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement had to find the sources of funding himself. The board managed to hire two investigators, but today that staff's been cut down to just one. Critics argue that the board is limited by design, specifically with regards to the contents of the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, which is a piece of Maryland state legislation.
There are two key provisions that prevent civilian oversight. One is that all investigations have to be conducted by sworn law enforcement personnel, so it prevents the outside investigators from a civilian review board from conducting the investigations. And then two, no meaningful discipline can be imposed except by a trial board, which is again composed of fellow officers, sworn law enforcement officers.
Oversight of law enforcement officers is something that the city's mayor also recognizes needs reform.
You're taking a look. How can we make this board more relevant, more vital, and make it a place that the community feels is valuable, a valuable asset? And we're not there yet.
Last month, the mayor, along with Police Commissioner Anthony Batts, released a 41-page report that includes a list of recommendations.
This isn't fluff. We outline some of our dynamic training, including constitutional impartial policing, emotional intelligence, and de-escalation techniques, not taking things personally.
But many say that when the board doesn't have the legal means to properly address police abuse, the unchecked tensions, however small, culminate into more serious instances of brutality down the road.
If you can't take care of the small issue, it just keeps building, building. It just escalates into excessive force and harassment, so...
If the current review board is as ineffective as most everyone seems to agree, does Baltimore need to reform its review board in order to give the public proper oversight of its police force?
Now, we've heard this piece and we've heard from the voices before here. We have a guest here tonight, Alok Mukherjee from Toronto, who runs the Civilian Review Board, has a couple things to say about this. I want to hear his voice, then we can go back to the audience and let you respond to what he's saying. Alok.
The Police Service Act of the province requires that in every municipality where there is a municipal police force, there must be a police board, police service board. and it does not report to the mayor or the city council. It's an independent board that is made up of some members of the city council, appointed by the city council, and certain number of citizens appointed by the city council and by the province. So I'm the chair of our police services board almost 10th year now, and the board is responsible for appointing the chief and the deputy chiefs. Mm. Board has the power to terminate them. Mm. Board sets policies for the police service. Board sets annual priorities. Board conducts the performance appraisal of the chief. The budget of the police service is approved by the board, and then board takes it to the council. It's not a negotiation between the chief and the mayor. Board is the bargainer. Board is the employer. So I personally lead our negotiations with our police association. The law requires that every member of the police service must belong to either the police association or the senior officers association. And I lead the bargaining with them, which means that all labor relations matters are not the bailiwick of the chief, but the board. In addition to that, there's something very interesting. People were talking about accountability. The board sees itself as representing the public interest. So, for example, when we have inquests into deaths caused by police shooting or other action, the board is an independent party at the inquest, independent of the police service. And that's a very powerful position to be in.
Look, let me just jump in for a moment so we can get back to the audience. Let me turn to one of the people who go ahead.
My name's Dominique Stevenson. I work here in Baltimore, and I live in Baltimore for over 20 years. I want to go back to the issue of training. It's not training. You, Lieutenant Russell, you said yourself that nobody had to tell you to not brutalize anyone. That seems to be a contradiction to me. You all have acknowledged that this thing has its roots in slavery. And so I feel like we're here trying to come up with rational solutions to an irrational system. I really don't see reform. There has to be a really radical change. The other thing about the cultural misunderstanding is on our part as Black folks. We're misunderstanding the fact that these folks are fascists. Okay, that this country has become increasingly fascist in how they deal with us. Okay, that's the big misunderstanding. And in terms of solutions, we really have a job to educate folks in our community, to educate young folks about that, about the danger of policing. Because when you call 911, you never know what you're going to get. Okay, it's more than a joke.
Let me get one or two more responses back here, then we'll come over here. Go ahead, Belial.
I think when you try to actually assess a problem, you usually go to the root cause of the problem. But in this particular case, you don't go to the root, you go to the seed. And the seed is, it's racism, just like racism is an institution in America. And one of the points that I want to highlight myself, because I'm a lifelong Baltimorean myself, even within the Baltimore Police Department, you have racism that runs rapid. That's why you have a vanguard, because you wasn't allowed to perform certain duties like white officers. You wasn't even allowed to even go in to a rolling park. You didn't even have arrest powers to arrest a white person.
Absolutely.
You had to call a Caucasian to the scene and perform your duties. So for us to sit here and say that racism is not the seed of the behavior that's being perpetrated on a vulnerable population is, like Dr. Winbush said, it's delusional.
Let me ask Dwight Pettit to jump here for a moment. And Dwight, given everything people were just saying, what we said before, and what Luke was saying, I'm curious, given the history you have with defending people who have been brutalized and killed and families of those who have been murdered, what's, A, your response to what you've heard here, but also about what Luke said about where we might go and how you feel about that in all your years of practice and civil rights activism?
It's systemic, and the problem exists because of the aspect of property and race. You got to remember, slaves were property. And that's where the whole thing begins to originate and comes up. I mean, when Richard Nixon said, "What are we going to do about the Negro problem?" Mm-hmm. That was a signal when you talk about the creation of the war on drugs, which was really the war on us. So all of this history, you got to remember, it's only been developed in the last 100 or so years. So we're not a long time removed. Now, as a trial lawyer, do I see any overall change other than the political climate changing through political activism? I think in terms of the local issues, in terms of Baltimore City, for example, there has to be some price to pay. And what does America understand? Money. And that price that has to be paid is that police officers have to realize that not only do they have a judiciary system, as my brother said, that's going to prosecute them, but they're not going to gain economically by what they do. And I guarantee you, if they didn't have caps and the city had to turn around and pay some real money, they would find a solution to the problem very, very quickly. Let me just finish with this. When a police officer, and I have all the killings and all the shootings, and I asked them on the witness stand, I said, "Officer, after you were put on suspension, did you lose any money?" "No, I was paid." "What happened when you came back on the force?" "I was promoted." And then you turn around. Now I read that not only are they paid, and not only are they promoted, but now they can file for workman's compensation because of the stress that they incurred because they killed somebody? Give me a break.
So
in addition to being paid, they not only need to be fired when you find that they have violated somebody, they need to be sent to jail. And it would stop. It would stop. You send three or four of them to jail, it would stop.
And the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights, in my view, allows for that. They ought to be arrested on the spot, because once they are arrested, once they are charged with felonies, the law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights says that the chief can suspend them without pay. That's what you do. That's what I mean when I say immediate.
Make that clear. For felonies.
Immediate action. Mm-hmm. Police lock up people every day. Why don't they lock each other up?
Right. Because the police cannot go.
Seema, and tell folks who you are.
Oh, my name is Seema, and I am the policy director at the ACLU in the District of Columbia. While I won't deliver recommendations about Maryland, my colleague here from Maryland can do that. I can say that in the district, what we've learned by this failed war on drugs is that punishment does not deter bad behavior. In the district, we have locked up a staggering amount of really black people, where the war on drugs has been selectively enforced on the black community. Black people making up only 50% of the population, but 91% of the arrests for things that have been criminalized that we know white people actively engage in, like the use of marijuana, for example. More than 45,000 arrests every year, where 96% are for nonviolent offenses. So when we talk about the police interface, the over-policing of the black community, it cannot be explained by so-called black-on-black crime, because so much of these interactions are about nonviolent offenses. What I think we do know is that you can incentivize, you can create perverse incentives which drive the type of disparate policing we're seeing. So what are those incentives? The federal grants, which create monetary incentives on high number of arrests for nonviolent drug possession charges. But in no way do I mean to intimate that the war on drugs is the beginning or will be the end of the war on black people in this country. I think we all understand that it's the reproduction of inequity is a part of every institution, the founding of the society. And so I admire our colleagues' explanation of how their system works. But we have deep work to do in unraveling the system that has, served to incarcerate us both inside and outside prison.
Let me ask a question, just a show of hands. How many people in this room think we need a civilian review board in Baltimore? And one that has powers similar to what we heard in Toronto.
Oh, exactly.
Okay. So I'd like to talk a little bit about, from your perspectives and from the police perspective, their response to that, and also how do we get there? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Russell, go ahead. But I don't do it. There's a lot of people from Russell, and I want to get around the room here, here and here and here. But I really want you to focus your responses on the question I just asked about civilian review boards. Should we get there? How do we get there? And your thoughts on that, Russell?
I think as was depicted in that that viewing, one of the things is we have to be very real with ourselves and acknowledge that we have a civilian review board, but it has no teeth.
Well, we know that, right?
And so knowing that and understanding that, part of the reason why we're gumming at the issue is because we've got the LEOBR. We have to...
LOVR?
The Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights.
Just one of the acronyms get confusing.
We have to tear that down to the core, because the one thing that we do know is this, and human nature is this. If I keep making a mistake, if you smack my hand, I've learned my lesson. Behavior is learned. If you don't have something that takes away that protection from them, the only thing you're doing is enabling them to continue to do the same thing over and over again, because I'll be on suspension with pay, I'll hold out till I retire or until a new administration comes in, and I'll work my way through the system. We have to have an immediate mechanism right now, and that is tear apart the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights right now as it exists, so that a civilian review board then begins to have more teeth and the ability to do something about it.
So let me, sitting here watching people respond before I come over here and back over here. So the question I have, though, how do you approach that, Melvin Russell, as a police officer? How many years have you been on the force?
35.
35 years. And people know you all around the city and have a lot of respect for you as well. I'll say that. What is your perspective on the civilian review board? Does it make sense? You heard what Luke was saying, how it works in Toronto. Can that work here? Should it work
here? I know a lot of people that want to get in. So my answer is I would welcome that with open arms today, yesterday, if we could do that. If you guys could figure out how to do that, I would welcome that with open arms. And I would think the vast majority of the police department would want those. And the ones that wouldn't want those are the bad seats that you're trying to root out anyway. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we will welcome that. I love that. I was excited when you were talking about it.
Kenneth?
I don't have to agree with that.
So I want to come back to this point with the two of you, but...
Yeah, I think we can't forget that for our civilian review board to be meaningful, we also need our elected officials and the people responsible for running our city to understand what we're talking about. I think part of the issue that I've seen is, for example, when the city enacted our new curfew law that we knew was going to bring more kids in contact with police when they've done nothing but be outside. We're inviting these kind of interactions. And what I hear a lot of times is a disconnect between what folks are saying their experiences are on the street and the reality of what elected officials are saying that they see and they understand. And so that's why we keep hearing training is the answer. In terms of the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights, I want folks to know that Maryland has one of the most protective law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights in the country. In the country, even, you know, Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights are not uncommon, but we have one of the most protective in the country, and that is directly responsible for our inability as communities to hold police accountable. And, you know, whatever we say about the efficacy of civilian review boards, we can't solve the problem if we can't identify it, if we don't have transparency. Right now in Maryland, if you file a complaint against a police officer, you cannot find out what happened.
Right.
You cannot find, as the complainant, as the victim of police misconduct, you can't find out what they did. We need to fix that.
So let me go to the back of the room. You've been holding your head up a while, then I go over to here and over there and over here. All right? Go ahead.
I'm Danielle. I'm from the People's Power Assembly, which is a continuation of the All People's Congress, who actually worked with the community to pass the current the review board. But the thing is, it's been incredibly watered down, and it's up to us to... take action once we leave this room. You know, I hope everyone's been following what's been going on in Ferguson and all the wonderful work they're all doing there. As soon as the grand jury decision comes out, we need to all be at McKeldin Square at 4 p.m. If it comes out later in the night, then it will be the next day. But 4 p.m., the day of, at McKeldin Square, we need to all be there and keep, you know, not give up. And we really need to follow what the Black Panther Party had, a part of their review board. And we need to make sure that police are from their own community.
We're focusing here for this moment on the idea of a civilian review board. Can it be effective in our community? How can it work?
Well, my point would be that no civilian review board can be effective unless Black people in Baltimore are organized enough to force them to do what they're supposed to do. One of the problems that we've had continuously in Baltimore is that we do a lot of talk, do a lot of protesting, we do a lot of walking around concerned and angry about the police, but we don't do any organizing. Right. And so the first thing that we need to do in Baltimore, if we understand that institutions like police forces and police around this country are animated by racism and white supremacy, the thing we should be doing is creating Black institutions that hold them directly accountable, and not the typical ones. We need to create ones that are socially, politically, and economically free of forces that have kept us oppressed in this system of white supremacy. So that's where we need to start. And the problem is, when we don't start there, we end up rehashing these same issues over and over again, talking about civilian review boards. There are several bureaucratic boards created in every system of government that are supposed to hold them accountable, but we don't have organized systems and organized organizations that are independent of white supremacy. The problem is when we don't have that, there's no way we can actually expect them to perform as expected. So that's where we need to start, to build black institutions first and to build organizations that can hold them directly accountable.
So did you have a mic back there? Clayton?
Clayton Guy, director of the Rose Street Community Center, East Baltimore. Behind the citizen review is elected officials and so forth. Okay, now, we've been registering people to vote in the community for a while. We registered over 100 people. Out of the 100, maybe 10 of them was eligible. They got letters back saying, don't go vote. If you do, it's a felon. 5 years in jail. Mm-hmm. And people don't know that. Wow. So the power, we don't have power at the poll. These young guys are going to the poll. These young guys are registering, but the government, from the city council on to Annapolis, on to the White House, is telling them, because you've been in jail, you're not a citizen. So we are saying, look, we say keep on registering, because sooner or later, they're going to lock one of you up, and we're going to have a test case.
Jill, and then over here.
Thanks. Just briefly, I want to say that the Civilian Review Board giving it strength and authority is legislation. It's state legislation.
Mm-hmm. It can't happen in the city.
Revising the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights is state legislation. Making sure that either expanding voting laws for ex-felons or making sure the laws are enforced as they are is your politicians in the state legislation. And I wanted to say on that, I believe we do have to take action when we leave here and not just talk about it and complain, but we have to be organized, as Adam said, to support these issues in Annapolis. And so, for example, mm-hmm. It didn't just come out, you know, this year or after the last meeting that we saw. Right. People have been sponsoring legislation in Annapolis to give more authority to the Civilian Review Board for years, for a decade. I've been sponsoring legislation to change the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights since the entire time I've been there, 10 years. And so these are issues that we need to bridge that gap and have a connection on. And then finally, I'll just say that the Baltimore delegation, the state legislature, is having a pre-session legislative hearing on all of these policing issues next Saturday at University of Baltimore at 2 o'clock, which is important for everybody to be there.
This coming Saturday.
The 22nd. And so that is the beginning of moving toward Annapolis to change some of these laws.
And okay. Identify yourself, please.
Okay, Reno Thompson. I've been born and raised in Baltimore. Matter of fact, about 10 blocks from here. But the Citizen Review Board, need somebody on that board with a pit bull mentality. And if it's not, it's not going to be effective because it's not going to be respected. If you're not going to have someone on there that is going to take these issues and run with it, it's not going to be respected in the community. And just to go back real quickly, those of you who are talking about a lack of training, I'm going to say what Arnold used to say on Different Strokes. What are you talking about? Because it's not a lack of training. It's a lack of respect for the community. And there's a lack of disrespect for the badge and themselves. If the officer don't respect the community, this is what you're going to get. When I grew up, the officer talked to people. They came up, walked up to you. Hey, how you doing? Hey, how was your day? You don't have that. They'll walk like statues. You say something to them, they're all offensive. I mean, I understand they have a hard job to do, but it got to come to a point where, you know, you have to gain respect for the community. It goes both ways, but you have to gain respect for the
Mark,
community.
Mark, can I clarify just the training piece, just real briefly. So when I talk about, and I don't want to feel like I don't want you to feel down that I was being a contradictory. When I talk about lack of training, when we came up in this agency or any police agency, you were from the neighborhoods. You lived in the neighborhoods. But you please understand, let us not be ignorant to the fact that we're getting police not just from Baltimore. As a matter of fact, from the state of Maryland, and I'm going to just be real frank with you, we're probably getting 40% from the state of Maryland that are Baltimore police officers. And when you shrink it down to Baltimore City, it's ridiculous. 60% are coming from outside of Maryland. Mm-hmm. Then when you talk about grabbing people outside of the country, right, and now being police in a culture they don't understand.
They don't understand. Right.
This is why I said there's training is necessary. Because you can't bring somebody from another continent, from another country, from another neighborhood, halfway around the country, and say, now police this culture. Maybe I came from some place with no black folk. And now you want me to be in a community, mm-hmm, and police black folk? I don't even understand them.
All I know about him is what I saw on TV.
On the wire.
On the wire.
You understand what I'm saying?
On the wire.
So now you got me in the community. So, no, exactly. Listen, we're beyond that. Listen to me. Let me not get to that portion, because that's a whole other can of worms. That's a whole other can of worms. But let me just finish this. I'm not the hiring process. I'm not the process. I'm just trying to explain to you the situation we're in. So if you're going to bring, but listen to me. I hear you. I hear you. But if you're going to bring people in from all over the country.
Wow.
Right. I don't. That's not what I'm talking about.
Listen.
I agree. And this is not the dialogue.
We're there. Okay.
We're all on the same page. I agree with the dialogue. They should be coming from right here. But the reality is they're not. So if you're going to bring people in from outside, there has to be some level of training. Because I can't go to a corner where I've never even, first put me in the community, I ain't never seen no black folks.
That's right.
Then I got five black folks, young boys on the corner, passed down.
Right.
Can I be honest with you?
But part of the fundamental problem is bringing them in from the outside.
So,
we're on the same page.
So wait a minute.
We're saying the same thing.
I got it.
Folks, one second.
I didn't mean to go all down that road.
No, that's cool.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. That's an excerpt from a town meeting that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network in Baltimore around the question, should the community control the police? There's much more of this discussion to come after this break. On our way to break, we're hearing Marvin Gaye's How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. Marvin Gaye's incredible love anthem entered the charts on this day in 1964. Sing on, Marvin Gaye.
I need someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Michael Jackson's Thriller. Jackson's 14-minute video premiered in Los Angeles on this day in 1983. And you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And today on the program, we're listening back to an important community town hall event that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network, which I moderated. We wrestled with a question we've discussed a lot here on The Mark Steiner Show. Should the community control the police department? Could a police civilian review board with real power be the answer? Included in the discussion were Baltimore law enforcement officials, public officials, activists, and community members. Since this is pre-taped, we obviously can't take your calls. However, if you hear something during the course of this discussion that inspires you, please tweet me at Mark Steiner or email me at talk@steinershow.org so we can continue this discussion on the air in the coming weeks. Here's more of that conversation.
With Baltimore's Police Review Board not having the power to actually hold officers accountable, it's worth looking at those in several cities around the country that do. Cincinnati has a model review board that was established after federal intervention into longstanding accusations of brutality, profiling, and the killing of the 15th black man in 6 years by police resulted in a three-day uprising by enraged community members. Stakeholders, including the union, agreed police practices needed an overhaul. In the case of a fatal shooting, police are now required to hold a press conference within 12 hours, release the name of the officers involved, along with the dash cam footage from the squad car. Members of the Independent Citizen Complaint Authority are appointed by the mayor but approved by the city council. Unlike Baltimore's board, it can subpoena officers and is mandated to investigate every non-criminal accusation within 48 hours of the complaint being filed. Discipline is determined by board vote and handed down by the city manager, outside of the police chain of command. But the ACLU of Ohio's Michael Brickner says police abuse does continue.
Collaborative agreement was not some silver bullet that takes away all policing issues, and that, you know, I would never represent that there aren't still problems in Cincinnati, that race profiling does still occur, that there are incidences of excessive use of force in Cincinnati, and there have been throughout the process.
Another model review board is Washington, D.C.'s Office of Police Complaints, also established after a civil rights investigation and resulting consent decree. City similar in size to Baltimore, the board has a $2 million budget, full-time staff, and 20 investigators, versus Baltimore's all-volunteer board with one investigator and a shoestring budget.
In the national context, the DC Police Complaint Review Board is one of the most effective, one of the models. However, it is almost completely ineffective. At this point, we are seeing very, very few complaints which are being sustained. And where they are sustained, the chief of police, Chief Lanier, has, you know, her position is that the recommendations of the complaint review board are sort of advisory opinions. She doesn't have to follow them.
The Washington, D.C. Office of Police Complaints Board does not have the power to hire and fire the police chief. Instead, the chief reports to the mayor. Detroit is another city that faced federal investigation after police killed nearly 50 people in 5 years. Before it was dissolved by Detroit's emergency manager, its civilian review board was elected and had the power to nominate the chief of police. Activists credit the reform with a sharp drop in the number of African Americans killed by police. By contrast, the City of Toronto's Police Services Board is a very different model. The board is comprised of two city council members, civilians appointed by the city and the province, and the mayor can choose to sit on the board or be replaced with another city council member. The police chief handles discipline, but the board hires and has the power to fire the chief. And after being criticized for not better overseeing the highly maligned police response to the 2010 G20 protest, where over 1,100 people were arrested, the board is now asserting its authority over day-to-day policing. But despite the board's efforts to stop racial profiling of the City of Toronto's lowest-income communities of color, press investigations and public surveys have found the practices persist. It's caused a public dispute between Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair and Board Chair Alok Mukherjee. The police chief has publicly attacked Mukherjee for saying he found the ongoing racial profiling extremely disturbing and problematic. The Toronto experience shows having a powerful review board can address policing practices, but needs popular support to fully implement its legislative mandate. From Baltimore, this is Jessel Knorr.
They want to shoot my people because we shooting stars. Want to dim our light, hate how bright we are. Ancestors of Roma is smelling pretty hard. Commit in my kinship, hate how tight we are. Now racism had a mistress named white privilege. She put her feet up, let the color folk do the dishes. Being black is just like being a bicyclist. In a world that's predominantly car-centric, the system's not broken, not meant for you. You colonize my land, then you colonize my classroom. Our lineage don't have a lane, pursuit of freedom filled with pain. If Aunt Jemima was to sing, it would sound like acid rain. They speak hatred into ourselves before we speak for ourselves. Now, we can't speak at all unless blood's the motivation. Got to get shot down in the street before peace becomes impatient. Striving for justice in the jungle where tigers can't be tamed. I got the language and last name. I'm a reminder of the pain, a reminder of the death, the colonization contest. Police treat black boys like liquor shots. Whose round is gonna be next? See, guns make God out of humans, make men into martyrs. There's no life in tomorrow. Blood showers in sorrow, mourning into the morning. So tired our soul starts yawning. So we wait on freedom like the second coming. As if we got time like the second's coming. He got shot once, but here's the second coming. Then the blood starts running, complacency confronted. So what you gonna do when your freedom's revoked? When your distractions go up in smoke? Are you gonna sit by the TV while they hook up the IV, screaming freedom, freedom? We ain't seen none, seen none. Freedom, freedom. We ain't seen none, seen none. See, they wanna shoot my people cause we shooting stars. Want to dim our lights, hate how bright we are. Ancestors of Roma is smelling pretty hard. Commit in my kinship, hate how tight we are.
So we want to thank Fire Angelo, this incredible poet, for Shooting Star. And how she puts into the words of a poet, how the poet puts into words the feeling that people have throughout this community about what people are facing. So I want to thank you for what you bring to us. I really want to wrestle with, what do we do? How do we make this work? I'm going to do this in two big parts to open it up. The first part, I would like to turn back a loop for a minute. And I'll focus for a minute on with you about the difficulties in doing what you do on a civilian review board. How it doesn't always work. The opposition you might face to stop what you're doing and clear the tensions between you and some of the police. But what are some of the obstacles to the work of a civilian review board, even in a place like Toronto, where it might work fairly decently?
First part was the good part. This is the not so good part. There are moments when there is resistance. It happened, for example, at the time of G20.
Which was an international meeting of leaders in Toronto. The people protested.
Leaders from across the country, they met in downtown Toronto. And what we found was the board's policies were not implemented, even though board was assured that they will be. I brought in a retired chief justice of the province to look at governance and what was deficient. It always goes back to one thing, and that's in the law. The law makes a separation between policy making, which is the board's responsibility, and implementation or operation, which is the chief's responsibility. And the law says the board will not interfere with the day-to-day operational matters.
So before, let me just interrupt for a moment, because I'm trying to apologize just very quickly. Because, Paul, when the real news was out of Toronto and you were doing work there, and you covered what Alok was talking about with the G20. So could you just describe a moment actually what happened there to get people a sense of what was going on that created this board? And come back to Alok.
The Ombudsman of Ontario called what the Toronto police did the gravest violation of civil rights in the history of Canada. I think it was a bit of overstatement when you look at what happened to Native peoples. But at any rate, about 1,000 people got arrested. At least 1,000 or more got viciously beaten, and beaten with impunity. There were cameras everywhere. Every officer knew everything they were doing was on tape. And everyone obviously knew there would be no repercussions. Horses were driven over top of people. Women were threatened with rape as they were taken in hauled. They actually did snatch and grabs Latin American style, where they would take a protester, reach them into a van, and drive off to the holding place. They were shooting tear gas into people's faces. It was at a level that was so disproportionate to what was going on, because it was almost entirely a peaceful demonstration, except for a small group called the Black Bloc, which had been infiltrated by the police completely and came out in court that some of the Black Bloc people who were advocating violence were actually cops. It was a setup. Toronto police and police forces around North America are learning how to suppress mass protests. The review board was kept out. Turned out it was actually a federal operation. The RCMP was leading all this. But it was a grave, grave series of abuse. After they turned the whole of downtown Toronto into what the ombudsman called martial law. There was no rights. Alok and his review board afterwards had to kind of make some sense of it.
And that is a very good example of what happens when policy is separated in such a watertight manner in law from operations. So we brought in a chief, former chief justice. This is his report. Wow. And it's about governance. How does a community govern its police in the public interest? And the judge made significant recommendations which we have implemented. One of the things the board did do, back up a little, actually today is very interesting in the city of Toronto while I'm here. The superintendent who ordered the kettling of 420 innocent people in pouring rain on Sunday evening of this summit is now on trial, and his trial began today. It took a long time, so many years, and the trial, and I'm sure it's the same here, it's a hearing by a judge, it's public. So public can see it happen, the evidence will be shown in public. The other thing the board did, there were 100 police officers who violated board policy and removed their name badges in order to conceal their identity. I asked the board to withhold their recommendations for their reclassifications, that is to say promotions, for 6 months. That was a significant monetary disincentive, to go back to what you said, to make the point that board policies matter and you will follow board policy. But there is a big gap, and that becomes the big challenge. How does the board make sure that the operations are truly in compliance with intended policy? And right now, that has crystallized around the issue you have been talking about this evening. How does Toronto Police interact with people of color generally and black youth in particular? Data for several years that there was over-policing of black youth. It was called carding, unlike stop and search here. In the name of informal contact, were being stopped, and their particulars, as well as their friends' particulars, were being put in police database.
So let me ask this question, which is to get other people's conversation as well. So one of the things, the subtext here, to me anyway, is that these things don't work unless there's a forcing community push them to work.
That's right. One of the newspapers, Toronto Star, took this story up since 1999. Every 2-3 years, they did a complete statistical analysis. And when the last analysis came, I said, this has gone way beyond the level of acceptance, and the board is going to step in now. Obviously, the service has not, police service has not.
I want Ray to talk a bit about the other two cities where he's been studying, where it's working halfway decently.
There's only two cities where there is any kind of effective community review boards, Minneapolis and Portland, Oregon. In all of those cities, the FOP has opposed police oversight. They don't want it. And they'll tell you that if they don't, if they do get it, they will also sue to get it. So, you know, like you asked the question earlier, whether or not there would be, you know, we want community review. I would love one, but whether or not it's going to be effective is a totally different story. And it's the exception, and it's a minor exception rather than the rule.
So let me do this quick piece that I want to interject here for the audience to get a sense of, because when we talk about building movements in the city and getting things moving, there's an example in our midst. For just a minute, pull out that example, because it's a group of small people who made a huge difference in this last election and began to push the city in a different direction. And so let me just go there, then we can come back to all of you with the mics to continue this, because I think this is an important piece to where we could go and how. Sonia, I want you to introduce this.
I asked Mark to allow me to just really publicly acknowledge the role that the family of Tyrone West and has played in changing our conversation. I told this to Tawanda when we were standing outside in the rain, but I think as a civil rights lawyer, I cannot think of anybody in the time that I've been in Baltimore that has done more to raise the issue. And part of the way you have done that is by not letting anybody forget your brother's name, right?
Right.
And you have been there over and over and over. And you have made all of us feel accountable, made all of us feel that. And that is really significant. There's no substitute for that. So thank you.
So let me pick up on that and turn to Tawanda for a minute, because I want to just reiterate what Sonia was saying. Tawanda has been on my program numerous times since her brother was killed. And I just want to say that it's an example of what perseverance does. Tawanda has become a serious community leader, nationally, internationally, and locally, because of the work she's done to bring justice for her family. And her family never stopped. They stood out every Wednesday demanding change. And in my book, in this last election, one of the reasons our state's attorney lost was because of the anger and passion created by their movement. So I just want to say that. And Tawanda, go ahead.
And I just want to say that, you know, people don't realize the power that you have. And first, power comes from love. And when they put these officers in here that don't care about us, that don't love their self nor love us, and we are being brutally murdered, it's black people. It's no secret. It's black people. It's poor people. So it is a race thing. But my thing is, we have the power. We need to shut them down. You hit them in the pockets. That's how you shut them down. I feel like Black Friday is coming up. We need to, everybody need to come out, wear black, go to the malls like you can buy something, and don't buy a thing. Buy nothing. Buy nothing. We sitting back waiting for the Michael Brown verdict, which we already know which way that's going, because they already got the National Guard. So that's predicting the answer right there. We never going to get justice. Justice to me is those killer cops being arrested, just like you or me if we kill somebody. So like I said, hit them in the pocket. Shut them down. We don't got to support their stores. We don't got to support their foolishness. Shut them down. We are doing something for us. The West Coalition, that's our list of demands. With everything like you were talking about, the civilian review boards, just a list of demands to get actions and changes done in the city.
And introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Brittany Price, and I am a junior at Connections Community Leadership Academy. We changed our name so many times. But I would just like to say thank you for having me today. Y'all talk, I've been listening to y'all, and y'all been talking a lot about the future and about the movement of stuff and things like that. But what y'all fail to realize is the youth is our future. And y'all haven't acknowledged the fact that y'all have to educate our youth on certain things for y'all not to have this similar problem going on in the future. And I feel like education holds a big, it's like a big priority that needs to be said and done, because not only in my school we have a class, it's our English class, and we've been reading Mr. D. Watkins' essays, and it kind of opened our eyes a lot about not only police brutality, but a lot of stuff going on in the world that we have not actually acknowledged. So it's about, y'all talk about like stuff that can be done and stuff that should be done, and it's the fact that I have two questions. It's like, how do you educate the youth on the confusion we have to either trust the police or not trust the police? Because I can go up Montgomery Mall today, and they will tell me that I have to go get on the bus right now. It's no waiting. It's no, I'm waiting for my sister. No, it's no, get on the bus right now. But then I go downtown, and oh, I can just walk down there freely sometimes. Sometimes.
What do we think that prevents people in Baltimore from being Ferguson, from being in the streets the same way, or taking those kind of stands? We're talking about youth, right? And when you look at Ferguson, Ferguson is being driven by young people. They're running that situation. As I say, this is not your grandfather's civil rights movement. It's not my civil rights movement. It's a new civil rights movement. So how is that happening? Who wants to jump into that real fast?
And I think it's more of something will happen to the, I guess, the right person. They're going to cause uproar here soon, because the pattern I'm saying, the police is very, very aggressive. I mean, I was labeled a felon, you know what I mean, and because the things I've done in my past, and it's like the police, when they in your neighborhood, especially like the Caucasian police, you can see the racism like in their eyes sometimes. Like you can feel it, and I really think that they need to have some kind of board where, as though, like in a neighborhood, like you should be able to, like the size the police up. I mean, do something to see, is this man racist? Or make it mandatory that the police come from that community or come from Baltimore. Because I'm telling you, man, these police, and some of them, I mean, you really can see the racism in them. I mean, how they talk to you, how they treat you. It's just all just aggression and anger.
So what you just said there, let me pick up on this for just a minute. And I'm picking up this because we talk about civilian review boards, and I'd like to hear how maybe Toronto deals with that, or how D.C. deals with that, or how they've dealt with it in Cincinnati. But how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the overt racism that is practiced by some police officers in this community who have just complete disregard for black folks? And I'm going to turn to Sina, because I'll tell you a quick story on the way to Sina. One of my former producers, who is white, was stopped on Maryland Avenue, and there were four black men near her. The police pulled up and started harassing the men around her and put them up against the wall. It had nothing to do with one another. She tried to intervene. They said, okay, little girl, we got it. And then as they let these guys go, they started talking to her in the most racist terms about who they had just stopped and why they stopped them. So if you're white, you hear that. And you know, if you are a person who fights racism, you know what that means. So the question is, how do we deal with that? How does the Civilian Review Board or anything else address that deep issue?
The demands that have been coming out of Ferguson is about having black police officers, having officers from the community. And I can say from the D.C. experience, black officers may be necessary, but it is not sufficient to bring about justice.
Not at all.
In D.C., studies have shown, not just in D.C., but beyond, that an encounter between a black male and a black officer is not less likely to result in a rights violation or even an arrest. We've all been in this country rubbed up against this racist institution, and some of it has definitely rubbed off on the way people see things. So I think that's one piece to keep in mind.
Let's go back here, the woman in the red.
Hello, everyone. My name is Shayna Bateman. I am a caseworker at the Youth Empower Society Drop-In Center for Homeless Youth. Lieutenant Colonel Russell made a very valid point about police officers coming from that neighborhood. One of the things to consider is the self-worth that a police officer has when they're policing the neighborhood that they come from. And it's also important to note the interstate incarceration, where when you are arrested and sent somewhere else, the tax dollars from that area follow you to where you go and fund you at that prison. So maybe if we looked at, you know, how that affects someone who's not from a particular neighborhood coming into that neighborhood, it's easier to arrest someone from a neighborhood you're not familiar with when you know in the back of your mind their money is going to fund a warden, a nurse, a CO, a PO in another area. And let's say it's your area, that just keeps the economy going. That's something to take into consideration for future progress and future processes.
Dave, there's a question I really think is important. We need to come back to from all these comments we're making. Are we ready to organize in this community to make something happen? And how does that happen? And looking at Davon, because Davon and other people from Leaders for Beautiful Struggle did organize that kind of movement that helped stop the construction of the jail in this community. And they did that.
Well, I want to say two things. The first is that I think it's really important we understand why we're having this conversation right now, because I think sometimes it's easy to mistake a convenient political conversation with genuine care about the conditions that are existing in our community. And so I think it's really important that whenever we have this discussion that is connected to specific things that we're going to do in our communities and in the political arena, so that it doesn't get absorbed into the political discourse and people play political football. So, for instance, like the video cameras legislation that's in the city council, honestly, that's just political football, because none of the folks that were elected said anything when at the time Mayor O'Malley arrested 757,000 people in the city of Baltimore, right? So it's important that we connect the things that we're talking about to specific things that we're going to do. So among those things, I think it's important, and we've talked about the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights. I think that's really important. I think in terms of getting a civilian review board that has teeth, that's really important. But what's even more important is that the people of and from the community are those that are in charge of administering and checking these institutions to make sure they're accountable to the community. Because what has happened is we have all these different apparatuses, these, you know, things, government agencies, bureaucracies that are created for the purposes of addressing some of these things, but they're not operated by people of and from the community. And so when we think about what the next steps are, it's important that folks of and from the community operate these institutions so that we're not relying on a governmental structure that has demonstrated its inability to effectively address our concerns.
That's an excerpt from a town meeting that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network in Baltimore around the question, should the community control the police? On our way to break, we're hearing Blur's Coffee and TV, because today is the birthday of bassist Alex Kingston, songwriter, author, columnist, and bassist for the band Blur. We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Bjork's Human Behavior. The Icelandic singer, songwriter, musician, composer, and actress was born on this day in 1965 in Reykjavik, Iceland. She's been described by critics as one of the most important and forward-looking musicians of her generation. We've been listening to an important community town hall event that took place earlier this week at the Real News Network that I moderated around whether or not the community should control the police department. And here's the rest of that conversation.
A review board is not a governing board. I think what we should strive for first is a governing board to take the power away from City Hall and let the citizens and that governing board design the police department in the way it should be.
So
and
very quickly
in the policies.
On that.
Now look, go ahead.
Our board is a management and oversight board that is the employer, policymaker, priority setter, all of that. We have a special investigations unit, which is provincial, that deals with police use of force.
Right. So what's key is policy and management first, and then you work it from the top down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and how effective is that? How effective is that in Toronto?
Well, I made a point about policy versus operation. In order for policy to be effective, it has to be implemented.
Right.
And what we are having difficulty with the racial profiling policy is policy says we must define public safety purpose. Chief says that's an operational matter. You cannot.
Yeah.
Policy says our policing must be rights-based, that you, police officer, must tell the individual you are meeting, interacting with, that they have the right not to answer your question and they have the right not to remain. Chief says that's operational. Policy says you shall not use carding as a productivity measure. You made that point. Mm-hmm. That you will not profile people and fill in cards as a measure of productivity. Is that operational or not? Those are the issues that we're having disagreement with, and that's where policy runs into difficulty.
Can I add one thing?
So we can learn from you.
Paul J.
I'm Baltimore now, and my kids are born here, but I'm from Toronto originally. On paper, this may be the best legislation in North America. If there isn't a mass movement, if the community isn't organized, Alok and a few of the people on his board are all out there on their own against the union, against... They're not renewing the contract of the police chief, but he's still there. He's fighting. And there, of course, there's a whole right-wing media in Toronto. So it does not stop the war. It's an important tool. It's an important weapon if you have it. But it's only a weapon if the people wield it. Otherwise, they're out on their own.
My name is Kim Humphrey. I'm an education and legislative advocate with the ACLU of Maryland as well. And my point was exactly that. You do need policy and you need implementation, but you have to have the grassroots. So his point about getting organized and staying organized, you have to show up in Annapolis. When people like the ACLU who are able to get the ear don't have the support of the community, we can't get anything done. So I don't know. I call on the community groups at the grassroots level to really hold the feet to the fire, get people organized, get the students involved that are dealing with this every day so that we can really make a change. I think that's the best way to do it. And the issues in Ferguson and things of that nature, we shouldn't have to wait till someone's laying dead in the street every time to take action, because we hear this stuff every day. And a lot of people are empathetic and they see that we have these boards that don't get anything done. So it's really a challenge for all of us here in this room to find a way to make this real and show people that when they come out, it doesn't even have to be at the poll, but when they show up to get a piece of legislation done, that it actually changes things.
So there's a challenge here to make that happen, and you have the mic next in the back. So how do you make that happen?
My name is Sonny Jones, and I'm a lifelong resident of Baltimore City. I'm also a Vietnam veteran, United States Marines. And I tell everybody, and anybody who knows me will tell you, that I start off by saying that I'm a street warrior, and I want to say that I want to say ditto to everything that Mr. Love said. He kind of stole my thunder on that a little bit. But so ditto to that, brother. But here's where I hold people accountable. As a black man in Bel Air Edison, I make it my personal responsibility to get out and walk my neighborhood, all parts of it. Top, right. Bottom, left, right.
Right.
And I meet these young men, whether they have a gun in their waist or
right.
drugs in their pocket,
right.
and I tell them one simple thing. I love you.
Say that. Say that.
One simple right. thing. I love you. So to be real brief, everything is interdependent and interrelated. So we not only need to have the civilian review board, we not only need to have the body cameras, we need a law to prohibit racial profiling modeled after Ben Cardin's SB 1670. Me and Brother Neil Franklin went to war with the city council on that 2 years ago. And I'm going to be frank about this. If we had not been swept under the rug, there are people in this room that would not have been attacked. And there are people in this room that would not have lost their loved ones.
So let me ask this question. Let me ask this question before I go back up here to the legislator here with us and some of the lawyers. Is that viable? Can that happen?
A law to, well, actually, in Maryland, we have anti-racial profiling laws, and we actually have a policy in place. If it's not, it may need to be, not repealed. I think it sunsetted the initial racial profiling, or it's about to. So we already have a law in place. I don't think that we can make a law that would prohibit racism unless there's accountability. And then finally, I just want to say while we're on that subject, that it is about legislation and organizing people. There's a big disconnect between where the laws are made and where people have the problems, Annapolis and Baltimore. And that's always a heavy lift. And when you talk about the union being by yourself, when you're a legislator sponsoring legislation to bring accountability and fairness and justice regarding policing, all of those same organizations are against you. And when the people aren't there to support it, it doesn't happen, mm-hmm. which is in part why we're bringing Annapolis to Baltimore Saturday to start beginning this organization process so that we're prepared this session to go to Annapolis to change the Civilian Review Board or Governing Board and to change the Law Enforcement Officer Bill of Rights, among other things.
This is one of the questions. We heard what Jill said, Delegate Carter said. The question is, we just had this election where the voters who came out before in Prince George's County, Montgomery County, Baltimore City, came out by, again, a third less. And people came out, I posit, not because they don't care. It's because they're sick of what they see around them and don't find a reason to come out. So the question I have for you in the community is, what do we do in the community to energize that force to make a change, whether it's voting or some other way, that they do come out? That's the question I have for you all. How does that happen to get the Civilian Review Board or anything else we want to get done in terms of controlling what's happening in our community?
Good evening, everyone. My name is Capri Shorter. I was born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. One thing that I think that we're all dancing around that seems to be always ignored is mental health. Racism is a mental health issue. And so we've briefly addressed the roots of policing and oppression and slavery. And all of those things are rooted in mental health issues as well. So I think that one thing as far as, I'm sorry, Mark, but to go back to organizing the Civilian Review Board, it needs to be addressing mental health. And that needs to be something that's happening more in the community as well. To go back to what the young lady from Connection said, also addressing mental health with the youth. You know, the young people are the people who are growing up and signing up to be cadets and police officers. Those are the people who we need to be saying, okay, hey, you know, what's affecting you in your workplace? What's affecting you, you know, at home? And if you're addressing it early, you won't have officers who are growing up with mental health issues and they're active officers on the force. So I think that the Civilian Review Board should definitely consist of a psychologist or a psychiatrist who can, you know, work with somebody who's actually within the police department to give some sort of daily assessment of officers to make sure everything is okay at home. Nothing is affecting them, you know, at home while they're on the job. Nothing is affecting them at that workplace.
So let me go around the room here. But look, you wanted to respond to that?
Since we're talking about community's role, mental health constitutes 30% of the workload of the Toronto Police Service. It's the biggest caseload. Mm-hmm. And we knew we were not doing well. What I did was to form a mental health committee, which includes people from the community as well as survivors and consumers, people who suffer from mental health themselves. Mm-hmm. So the police service, the police board, and the community working together to come up with solutions. That has been such an empowering process for us, where we have taken guidance and lead from the community to decide what we need to do. I just want to throw that out.
Hi, I'm Kiara Butler. I'm a cousin of Tyrone West. We have created a West Coalition. This coalition has forefronted a list of demands where we've actually asked for legislative changes and changes in the community that can be implemented in a way where we can actually see the change in the short term kind of framework. A lot of the things people are suggesting are long term changes where we don't have time for that. People are dying right now and things need to change right now. Having a mayor and a commissioner that are doing things to block
any type of legislation that could help people who right now need the help, who right now need their lives saved, who right now need to feel safe, is ridiculous. And I don't know why we're not addressing that issue right there. Because at a meeting with Nan, a civilian review board person who actually sits on the review board, stated that anytime they bring something to the commissioner, he denies it. They've said this. I don't know why this isn't being addressed, and I don't know why anyone is dancing around the fact that we have legislation in place where when people aren't doing things for the community, things can happen.
I want to get back to the question of how we energize the community.
Yes, my name is Travis, and I just want to know, you know, where is the state's attorney elect, Marilyn Mosby, tonight? You know, where is the city council tonight? You make the politicians, you know, the people have to believe. If they're going to sit there and vote for somebody, then the politician, then the people need, the politicians need to do what they say they're going to do on paper. And when they put up all these posters of what they're going to do, they need to do it because it's false advertising if you don't do what you're supposed to do. And, you know, we have to, like the mayor, the city of Baltimore just ordered thousands or about 300-500 cars. Why do we need 400-500 cars when we need cameras? That's oxymoron.
Marcus Dent, I'm one of the community leaders in East Baltimore. I'm actually one of the former Sector 2 leaders in East Baltimore as well. Lieutenant Colonel Russell gave us a charge about 18 months, 24 months ago, and he charged everyone in the community to take back the community. With that charge, it was a three-part charge. Number one, you actually have one community leader. Number two, you have a clergy member. Number three, you have a community police officer assigned to your sector. You're responsible for your sector. You're responsible for going around and building a relationship between your beat cop and between those folks that are on the corner, those folks that are in the storefronts, those children that are in and out of the schools. So those police officers, be they new, old, from Pennsylvania or from West Baltimore, they know you, they know your face, and they have a relationship with you. And over the last 18 to 24 months, that has been a groundswell of what we've been doing in East Baltimore. We're trying to get this citywide.
How do we sometimes what we always end up doing is we always end up looking at the authorities to help us figure out what to do. The question is, what do we do? What do we do? What does the community do is the question we want to talk about.
It has empowered the community because the community leader, that grassroots person, is actually the leader of that sector. So it has empowered us to be able to build those relationships and break down those barriers to tackle some of the problems and write down our goals for the future so we can take it down to Annapolis and enact legislation.
Young woman here in the corner, then we'll come back over here.
How you talk about organize our problem, we always dealing with the hierarchy top down. You build relationships with our at-risk children. You invest in them because each one of them know 10 people. You take 10 people that know 10 people, you got 100 people who've been boxed out. For real, the sister talked about it. The process is about mission goals, objectives, short-term, mid-term, long-term goals. People are up on things when they're in on. Our problem in this city, we deal with the hierarchies that don't change nothing. All of these pathologies are industry. The lady talked about the children that are not here, they need to be involved. They ain't trying to hear about civil rights. We have a personal investment in it. You can't help nobody unless you love them. We're doing a lot of rhetoric. Get the ordinary John 2 citizens involved, invest in them, and they take leadership. Systems ain't gonna change nothing. Systems make money off of problems. You gotta deal with the ordinary John 2 citizens that ain't got a clue what to do. You invest in them. You're talking about organizers. Systems don't change problems. They get paid for problems. It's real simple. We major in minor, and minor in major. That's why ain't nothing changed. I lived here for 67 years, and ain't nothing changed.
Young woman in the back.
Hi, my name is Olu Butterfly Woods, and I have been doing youth development work for over 13 years. And I want to say that I admire brothers like Davon Love, who not just have the passion for policy, but the patience And I have dabbled, I consider myself a community leader, and I have dabbled in council meetings, and I don't really have the stomach for it. And I know that, and I'm saying that because they are, to me, designed to be hostile to the community. That word is so misused. And I'm out that naive mob that the community includes homeless people, it includes young people that are committing crimes. They are the community as well. They are citizens. And so, you know, just in terms of spaces that I know this young lady, she represents a whole large group of young people that want to get involved. They care about their communities. So in terms of having people that have teeth or, you know, or maybe we're saying we're going to stop inviting them because they are, you know, I don't know, but they have my tax dollars. So they need to we need to find a way to get them in the room with real representation, not, you know, to have spaces. So all these people, and they're not going to Annapolis. They're just not. And in terms of these spaces where we can go to them, where they feel comfortable and they feel that they are actually heard, and community is a real term that we believe in and invest in and not just throw around conveniently. So, I mean, maybe that's an open-ended question, how we can get – there's plenty of people that care, and then there's these council meetings and such, and there's no – absolutely no connection. So how it can be a less hostile environment for the people who care, or even the man that's cleaning up in front of the 7-Eleven who I just saw the cop getting a donut, harassing him to get away. He is a citizen, and somehow that cop does not honor or respect or recognize that person as a citizen. So how can we get those people to be in the room and in these spaces that have teeth?
So, Adam, very quickly, then we'll go over here, this young man here.
The problem is that when we talk about, just like Olu said, we talk about these things about, like, transforming systems and how to transform the conditions of our community, but we don't actually believe in it. In Baltimore, we're talking about Baltimore to Ferguson. We should have all been in the streets marching for Tyrone West when he was shot by the police. How can we can organize mass marches and mass demonstrations for people who are not from our community, people who are black who we should feel love for, but we can organize mass marches and demonstrations and political agendas for people who are not from Baltimore, but we can politically posture in front of each other. And in Baltimore City, we're not even being specific to the people who are actually hurting our community. You know, for Martin O'Malley, for example, he, between 1999 and 2006, illegally arrested over 757,000 black people in Baltimore, and our elected officials did virtually nothing about it. And the thing is, we need to actually energize the people in our community. I work with young people every day who say, what can we do to make transformative political change? And I don't want to tell them go run for office because I don't believe in the political system. I don't want to tell them to go to the streets and protest because that's a finite political process. You go out and you protest and you go home. What we need to be doing is to actually teach young people to transform political systems in this country, especially in Baltimore, and to look at the people specifically and the specific policies and practices that are causing these problems. I get tired of political rhetoric. I'm 26 years old. I did debate. I heard enough political rhetoric my entire life. I'm not really interested in it. What I'm interested in is training young people to grow up, become the political leaders, people like Davon, who ran in 2011 when he was running for city council, people like Delegate Joe Carter, who worked with us to help stop a youth jail, who worked with us to pass a law in 2013 to stop that directly addressed police brutality with Christopher's Law. These are things that we're doing in our community right now with young people, but people aren't paying attention and people are not actually interested in authentic community engagement. If people are interested, you need to stop talking, get interested and get involved and show up instead of talking around the issue.
Right here, young man in black.
My name is Davon Neverdon. I'm the outreach coordinator for Alpha Justice, which is an ex-offenders-led organization. In our organization, we basically do the empowerment in reference to what the gentleman was stating right there, where, of course, bringing liaison work with the politicians, Mr. Dent, many other things we've done with Ban the Box and things like that. A lot of the kids are trying to get involved, but, again, we're locked out. That's why we have organizations out here. I worked with Miss the West family. I've worked with myself. All the grassroots organizations. We working. It's y'all not with us. I mean, I'm not faking with y'all. I ain't gonna fake with you. Like, I'm not gonna fake. I know Davon. He knows me. Miss Tawanda knows me. We don't know y'all. So I really think that, I mean, not to be funny, take the suits off. We feed the homeless Sunday. Right. Fayette and Front Street. We do books and barbecue throughout the whole city from the top of North Avenue all the way down. So, I mean, just come on and get on ride. Take your clothes off and come on down with us. Hi, Tawanda.
All right.
We as the West Coalition, we are trying to energize. And one of the ways we're holding people in our direct communities accountable. You have to pay attention to people's conversation. When you start to bring these type of topics up, they say, I'm good. I'm just worried about me and mine. You know what? I'm challenging my young folks that I work with and my adults to say, you know what? That's not what a man does. You haven't completed your mission of being a man until you invested in your community. And your community is more than what's in your house. Because when you go outside of this house, it's going to be that what's going to direct what's in your house more than what's in your house. So you got to clean up what's outside of your house so that you make sure that the dirt inside your house is clean too. All right, so you got to check. It's not a Facebook fight. And too many people think posting and liking something on Facebook is part of the fight. You're not part of the fight. You're part of the advertisement. And we challenging people to put their foot to the pavement and come out and put some real work in. It don't got to be about police brutality neither. Long as you're committing yourself to participating and into the positive in your community.
Faraji.
As we've been hearing, if we don't put the focus on the next generation, you know, we've having the opportunity with the American Friends Service Committee to go into schools, we're at connections, we're building relationships in the Gilmore Homes community. We're going in and we're talking to those who are highly affected about all of these issues. But again, it's about building relationships with folks. And we have to be the ones, those who are in positions of influence or those who have access to resources, we have to be doing that. So what we're doing for the American Friends Service Committee, one of the things is that we're organizing a day of action on Dr. King's birthday next year, January the 15th, which is a Thursday. We'll be coming out together, and as a day of action, we're asking for the end to police brutality and militarization. But along with that, we're going to have a demonstration, a rally, and a protest in the earlier part of the day. But at the second half of the day, we're going to have a tribunal, and that's going to give us an opportunity to hear from sisters like Tawanda and others who have been victims. We were in connections today. And I mean, the stories about from the students about their experiences being in the police is horrendous. And I mean, those are the stories that we should be hearing, and we should be supporting those families. So we're going to have a tribunal and then wrap it up with a strategy session, because we do have a list of demands. And we should have very, very small, winnable goals. I mean, these things are... it's so big, it's so complex, but at the end of the day, we're dealing with human beings and we're dealing with people's lives. And so right. We have to have a better strategy. We have to be clear about what we want, but most importantly, we need to organize and build strong strategic relationships, not with folks at the top, but for those of us who have been so-called disenfranchised, those who have been disregarded, and that's with young people, the next generation. The big thing that I saw from my experience with Connections today is that as much as we're having this conversation, they wouldn't even know we're having this conversation. They couldn't even tell you about it. They're just learning about Mike Brown. They're just learning about the struggle for social justice and why they need to be involved. That's a different part of the conversation. We can't make an assumption that the next generation already know, because there was a breakdown between the generation of 50 years ago and the generation of today. So while we were trying to get that money integrate and all of those things, something got lost in the transition, and essentially our community that we see today is the end result of that breakdown. So if you want to get more information, if you want to help us organize for this National Day of Action that's happening in 8 to 10 cities across the country, please see me later on.
So I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. This has been a very powerful conversation we've had in this community with people from all through this community. I'd like to thank all of our guests in the audience, members for being part of this incredible discussion. It cannot stop here. It has to continue between one another, at The Real News, on The Steiner Show, in the community, out in the streets, to make people hear what they say. We've got people in here. We've got the suits in here. We've got the non-suits in here. We've got the police in here and the community here to talk about it's time to build a movement for change. And I want to thank you all for coming to this Real News town meeting. Thank you all so much. Thanks for listening to our broadcast of The Real News Network's Town Hall. It took place earlier this week around the question, should the community control the police? Included in the conversation were the ACLU's Sonia Kumar, community activist Kim Trueheart, Adam Jackson, leaders of the Beautiful Struggle, chief of the Baltimore Police Department's Community Partnership Division, Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell, criminal attorney Dwight Pettit, former Black Panther leader Eddie Conway, Alok Mukherjee of the Toronto Police Services Board, and Dr. Ray Winbush of the Institute for Urban Research at Morgan State University. As always, if you have thoughts about the ideas you heard on today's broadcast, please tweet me at Mark Steiner or write me at talkatsteinershow.org so we can wrestle with your own ideas here on The Mark Steiner Show as we continue this conversation over the coming weeks and months. And on our way out of here, we're hearing What the Funk by the Memphis Horns. Why? Well, today's the birthday of Andrew Love, trumpeter and member of Memphis Horn Section, which were made famous by their numerous appearances on Stax Records. They appeared on nearly every recording for Stax that included a horn section, with Isaac Hayes, Otis Redding, Rufus Thomas, Sam and Dave, and you mentioned them, they were playing. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.